took notice in the bulletin, you know that tonight we're beginning a three-lesson series on some of the doctrines of premillennialism. And I realize that it's presumptuous to think that really, in three short lessons, you're going to say everything about premillennialism. You're not, and I'm not going to try to do that. But I am going to just do an overview of some of the major doctrines. Tonight, if you notice, for example, we're going to be talking about the Antichrist and the restoration of Judaism. I want to make a couple of brief announcements before we get into the lesson. First of all, I'm not sure what I put in the bulletin last week, but the song practice, first, the Friday night movie and Bible discussion will be on the 17th. I think that's right, the 17th. And that'll be, of course, 2 weeks from this past Friday or a week from this coming Friday, if that makes sense. And then on that Sunday, the 19th, at 5 o'clock, we will have our song practice. So all of you that are interested and want to come out, and we'll practice a couple of new songs. Went really well last time, good turnout, and I'm sure we'll have the same this time. Also, while I didn't do it this morning, let's make sure that we keep in mind the website. If you're not familiar with it, please go on it, www.eococ.com, and revisit, because there are things being added all the time to it, to the main page, as I tend to call it, and also to Michael's Corner. There's a tab on that main page to get to Michael's Corner, and I'm putting things on there, different things all the time. So go to those, check them out, and watch, hopefully, and join with us and get excited about the building of the website. A lot of work is being done by Edward, and a lot of work is being done by Wes, and so kudos to them, and thank them for all that work being done. And you can get involved, obviously, to attract people to that website. We have these cards. And if you don't have these little cards, Edward, he's got a bunch of them. He'd be glad to give you a stack of them. Grab maybe 10 or so and make it a goal to pass them out. The more we do that, hopefully, the more people will influence. So let's try to do that. Without any further delay, we'll get into the lesson. One final thing I do want to say. In fact, two things. So I'm glad I thought about that. We had, of course, a very serious service this morning. And I want to thank everybody that a lot of people stayed behind and gave words of encouragement. Please continue to remember Tina in your prayers and the family in your prayers. They're going through a lot. Give them your encouragement and your strength. And thank you for what you did today. And a bit of good news, really good news. Following that service, a little bit afterwards, we added a new sister in the Lord. So if you're not aware of that, Amelia Corella, and she's up here with TJ. She was baptized and became our sister and a member of the church here this afternoon. So you make sure, please, that you see her and encourage her. And, of course, we're thrilled with that. Okay, without any further delay, let's get into the lesson, because I know that there is, well, some kind of game that comes on tonight. And words from Inherit the Wind, I don't know why, but, you know, Inherit the Wind is a good old movie, and all through that movie there was a character by the name of Brady, and people kept going, Brady, 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 and I don't know, it's just been running through my mind. I'm just kidding. I'm really kidding. Because I know you guys are, a lot of you are Giants fans. Without any further delay, though, let's get into the whole doctrine of premillennialism. Let me give you a disclaimer. I'm going to talk a lot as though I believe in this whole thing just for the continuity of the doctrine. But please don't misunderstand. I don't believe in this doctrine, and I don't believe in these various points of this doctrine. So I'll start with that disclaimer. I'll try to make it clear throughout the lesson and the subsequent lessons that I don't. But I don't want to stop every 2 minutes and say I don't believe in it. So just so that that's up front. You know, it's a popular doctrine. Most people are familiar with it. The Left Behind series was just phenomenally popular among not only people in this country, but around the world. If you're not familiar with those books or those movies that starred Kirk Cameron, it really depicts, and I've watched them I think there were three movies. Does a good job of depicting the doctrine. It's decent entertainment. But aside from all of that, it espouses this doctrine that's not true. It is a belief that Jesus is someday in the future going to come back to earth and reign on the earth from in Jerusalem on the throne for 1,000 years. And there are going to be several events that lead up to that. We're going to talk about the first couple of them tonight in the lesson. He'll begin his 1,000-year reign when all of that starts. And a lot of people believe that that's close, that it's right around the corner. Maybe some of the things have already started. For example, there are a number of people that believe that the Antichrist, who is a central figure to this whole doctrine, that the Antichrist is possibly not only alive, but that all of that's in the works. And I've been hearing that for years, but there are a number of people who strongly believe in that. Let's talk about the Antichrist, because the idea of the figure of the Antichrist is foundational to this whole belief. The Antichrist. One particular diabolical world leader. One world leader that grows. He starts in one nation. He gains power. He grows in power. Eventually, the belief is that through the devotion, the admiration, the worship of people, he gains followers. He gains believers, if you will. But those who support him all over the world. And so he emerges as the world's great leader like we have never seen before. And there are various terms and ideas in Scripture. And I'll spend the bulk of the lesson talking about him. I'll mention the second part of it, the restoration of Judaism. I don't know how deeply I'll get into that. But that whole thing, the Judaism part of it, will overlap all of this. So there'll be bits and pieces of that throughout the three lessons that I do. But there are various terms in Scripture that are used for him as far as this belief portrays. Obviously, the main terminology for him is the Antichrist. And, of course, it is the belief that it is this one great figure. And I stress that because it will contradict, obviously, what I'm going to say from Scripture in a little while. But this one great figure who is Antichrist. The word anti or anti in the original language means against. So he is against Christ, but it also means instead of or in place of. And if you believe in this doctrine, you believe that he is the one who comes and then positions himself in the place of Jesus on earth. In other words, people begin to worship him, adore him, follow him as though they would Jesus. Now, the belief is, turn with me to Matthew 24, and I'll use some of the passages that premillennialists use to talk about the Antichrist. You won't see the term, incidentally, in these passages, but it has become so inseparable to the figure of the Antichrist, most people that believe in this doctrine would go to these passages and would believe exactly what I'm saying, that this is the Antichrist. For example, in Matthew 24, in verse 15, I remember we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I'm not going to re-preach Matthew 24. It was Jesus' prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem. And Jesus was giving some signs that would lead up to the destruction of the temple. And you'll notice he says in verse 15, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation." You'll notice he says, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. You'll note on the outline that I put out, you could go back to Daniel 9 and chapter 11 and again in chapter 12. And all three of those chapters, there are verses that speak of the abomination of desolation or the abomination that makes the temple desolate, etc. And we could go and historically show the fulfillment of that and how Jesus is applying it here in Matthew 24, but it doesn't matter. Because to the premillennialist, this is, all of those Daniel passages and the one in Matthew 24 are all pointing in the future to the Antichrist. And it's the idea, notice what it says here, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place." And then it goes on to say, Whoso readeth, let him understand. But the idea of standing in the holy place. Again, think in terms of that one who is going to emerge as a world leader, and I'll talk about in just a moment, a world religious leader. And he will literally then eventually stand in the temple, or the holy place here, and he will proclaim himself, exalt himself, not any longer as a mere human being, but divine. And he will demand the worship of the world. And so Matthew 24 becomes a central passage to this whole doctrine, the Antichrist. And here is a picture of the Antichrist and his positioning of himself in the temple. There's also the term the man of sin. Go with me to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. If I had to say that a second greatest or perhaps even greatest used passage, maybe misused passage, to describe this doctrine, I'd say it'd be 2 Thessalonians 2. If you look at this prophecy of Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2, you'll notice how it would fit if you were putting together this whole idea or buying into this whole idea. Paul was answering a false belief on the part of the Thessalonians. And that false belief obviously was they had misunderstood Paul to say Jesus was going to, he was imminently returning. In other words, Jesus was about to come. And you can even see in chapter 3, some of them have done what people do today. They had quit their jobs, they weren't working, they were simply just waiting for the return of Jesus. Now Paul, to defend against that, gives this prophecy, and of course by inspiration, he gives this prophecy. And if you'll notice what he says, he doesn't want them, verse 2, to be soon shaken in mind or be troubled, neither by spirit nor by word or by letter from us, like 1 Thessalonians, as that the day of Christ is at hand. Don't want you to think that I was saying the return or second coming of Jesus was close. I wasn't saying that. In fact, verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day, that is the day of judgment, the second day, second coming, etc., won't come except there first come a falling away. And then notice the phrase, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. And notice as he goes on to describe him, verse 4. Very similar, you see, if you had this belief, of what Jesus said in Matthew 24. Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he, and they would see this to be the Antichrist, you see, he as God sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. So this becomes the second passage, together with Matthew 24, even though we realize and can look at them exegetically and see they're two different things totally. Two different points being discussed, but to the premillennialists, they're the exact same thing. And now you have the Antichrist who stands in the holy place or sits in the temple. They see that as synonymous phrases. And both of them where this Antichrist is now proclaiming himself to be God. And so we see then, and as it goes on to describe here, if you'll notice, verse 8, for example, then shall that wicked one be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. They see the Antichrist, and if you read the books or watched the movies or heard the teaching or whatever, they see the Antichrist as empowered by Satan, and I stress that, empowered by Satan, to perform what they often call counterfeit miracles, or false miracles, or false signs. He does and accomplishes great things. They may not be miraculous. Some of them believe they are miraculous. But they're the working of Satan, and he's able to accomplish great things, quote unquote, great things, so that people say, you know, basically, there's no one like this guy, and we want to follow this guy, etc. And he wins people over. And generally speaking, what they see him doing is winning the admiration and the devotion of people in the world through these counterfeit miracles, basically becoming more popular than and more appealing than a Jesus whom a lot of these people in the world, you see, will believe has been dead or silent for 2,000 years, and now there's this new, exciting figure. It's not hard to understand that. We see people with their crazy devotion of human beings all the time. One thinks of an Elvis Presley or whatever it might be. People get, you know, really way off when it comes to certain people like that. That great charisma that some have. If you had someone whom Satan was empowering to have greater charisma than the world has ever seen, or whatever, who had the power of a whole nation or even nations behind them to accomplish great things. Like, for example, and I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I'll give you one example. They say this would be the guy who could get all the nations of the world together to stop global warming. And it would be that kind of impressive action that would win everybody over. And so they look at these passages like this, and they see a great figure emerging like the world has never seen. And thus, then, people begin not just to admire him, but to worship him. That goes hand in hand, that whole idea of Satan working with him. Go to Revelation, if you will, Revelation 13. It goes hand in hand with the passage in Revelation. Of course, Revelation becomes the great book, the one book that supersedes all others in talking about this whole doctrine. I'm going to spend a few minutes intentionally here on Revelation 13 because this is central to the whole idea of the Antichrist. You have to understand in Revelation 13, I'm sure everyone has heard of the mark of the beast. Even the casual person out there has heard of the mark of the beast. What a lot of people don't realize is that Revelation 13 actually talks about two beasts. And if you look at verse 1, you can see, first of all, there is this beast. If you'll notice, John says, verse 1, I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea. If you were studying this doctrine and looking at this theology, you would talk about the sea beast. Okay, nothing far-fetched about that. But you would ask yourself the question, who is the sea beast? And the sea beast, to make a long story short, becomes an all-powerful nation. A nation that has influence over all the nations of the world. Like the world has never seen in history, never has been. Now, think for a moment. Think about the United States for a moment. Some people, many premillennialists, point to the United States and say, what nation is like the United States? When you have people the world over, globally, who speak English, globally, who look to Wall Street to guide what they're, you know, what they think about their economy, what they're going to do today, and on could go, globally, who look to the armies of America for protection or leadership or whatever it might be, on and on we could go. Many see the nation of America as this nation described here. Read a few verses with me here. I saw this sea beast rise up out of the sea, had 7 heads and 10 horns, figured it for great intelligence, great mind, and great authority, the horns here. And upon his horns were 10 crowns, obviously symbolic of rule or power. And upon his heads there were the name of blasphemy. Notice that. And the beast that I saw was likened to, and there's description here, like there is in Daniel 7, for example, of the nations. The beast I saw was like a leopard. His feet were that of a bear. His mouth is the mouth of a lion. And the dragon, that's already been identified to be Satan in chapter 12, the dragon gave him his power and his seat and his great authority. So here is Satan that coordinates a nation, that helps it along, helps it grow in power, helps it get to the point that, and hear this, with the right leader could lead the whole world into, verse 1, blasphemy. Again, a lot of people point to America and say, look at everything that's gone right for America. From its inception to its resources, etc., etc., etc. Now, some of us might look and say, you know, America's got a lot of problems, you know. But comparatively, just think about how the world views this nation. And that's why America is often viewed as the beast here. All right, now notice as it goes on here. I saw one of his heads, verse 3, as it were, wounded to death. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. This is taken different ways, but primarily what is often seen in that is that there will be this leader, and it will look to all the world either a physical wound or a political wound or whatever it might be, but it will look to all the world as though this leader and perhaps even the nation with him are wounded to death. That he's so far down he can never come back, and then he comes storming back. And people are impressed with that. I mean, we're all impressed with the sports team that rallies in the last few minutes of a game or whatever and wins. I mean, we're just impressed with that. Did you see that? Et cetera. So they say, when you see something like this, again, it will add to that growing fascination is what I'm looking for, that growing fascination with the Antichrist. Now, continue reading. Verse 4, they worshiped the dragon, which gave power to the beast. And they worshiped the beast. The nation, remember, saying, who is likened to the beast, and who is able to make war with him? It's the military power more than anything. I remember premillennialists after the fall of the Berlin Wall, especially after Desert Storm 20 years ago, when, yes, we fought Iraq, but as most people pointed out, we fought the weapons of a once considered equal power in Russia and annihilated. And I remember people pointing and saying, who could make war with... And I remember the statements being made like that. Who in the world could go to war with America and stand a chance? And premillennialists would come back quickly and say, yeah, it's just like Revelation 13 says. It's that kind of idea, and you have to understand it. Now, as we're reading this, you're no doubt thinking, I would hope, and I'm thinking as I'm reading it, this was written in John's day and talking about something that was shortly going to come to pass. And doesn't this fit with Rome and the feelings about the nation of Rome and the power of the invincible? Well, of course it does. And that's what it's talking about. But a premillennialist doesn't see that. He sees today and a nation today. And you'll notice it goes on here. It was given him, verse 7, in particular, to make war with the saints. I won't turn back, but you can. Read Daniel 7, and you can see that in particular from Daniel 7, especially verses 15 and following. It was given unto him to make war with the saints, notice, and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds, and this is important, over all kindreds and tongues and nations. So what happens is, notice what's happened in this passage. What happens is there is this great leader, and he appears to all the world to be dead, mortally wounded. And he comes storming back, not just to regain his power, but to emerge as a leader over all the nations of the world. Now, as it goes on here, you'll notice verse 8. Because of that, people are so impressed, etc., and all that dwell on the earth worship him. Notice, except those whose names are in the book of life, except for Christians. And Christians become the persecuted, the hated, the ones that their prejudice is against on the earth. Everybody else is for the beast. Everybody else is for the Antichrist. Now, the beast is the nation, but verse 11 talks about the second beast. And it is the second beast that is the Antichrist. Now notice verse 11 as it says, I behold another beast coming up out of the earth. Sea beast, earth beast, land beast he's often called. Coming up out of the earth. And he had two horns like a lamb. If you go on the internet, punch in Antichrist. I did this today just to make sure. Punch in Antichrist and hit images on your Google or Yahoo or whatever. You will get picture after, you'll get some stupid pictures of Obama or whomever. But you'll get a lot of pictures, you get a lot of pictures of a horned individual, both classically hundreds of years ago and currently. He has two horns like a lamb, but in fact, he speaks as a dragon. What they will say about this Antichrist is he will appear gentle. He'll appear like Christ. He will win people over because he will portray himself to be a pacifist, a great ecologist, You know, he will end global warming. He will appear to be a person who's compassionate. He will institute world programs for feeding all the hungry of the world. You know, and there are countless millions of hungry people in the world. And all of that will attract, it'll just build the fascination with this guy and the love for this guy. Notice verse 12. He exercises all the power of the first beast before him and causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast. In other words, he becomes synonymous with the nation. It's much like the emperor of Rome, isn't it? The emperor became synonymous with the nation. If you worshiped Rome, you worshiped the emperor. The emperor was a god. You proclaimed him as such. His will, his word, wielded all the power of Rome. And that's exactly what they see the Antichrist doing. He does great wonders, verse 13. And, of course, the passage was read earlier. He deceives people on the earth. He, in fact, institutes the mark of the beast. When I was a kid, and a lot of you can remember this time, you'd go to the grocery store, for example, and I remember, boy, I had to be, what, 10 or 11 years old, and a guy came walking into the denomination I was part of, and he had this pamphlet. And in this pamphlet, there was a description of scanning. Now, do I have them on me? No, I don't. But my keychain, a lot of your keychains or whatever, you've got credit cards, and we know we live in the day where we scan everything, right? I mean, we scan, we go and we swipe the card, and we scan the little, you know, the little cars at the grocery stores and all that. We live in that age. But think back, some of you that are older. In the 70s, you went to the grocery store, and you went up there, and the items came across, and she punched in an old-type cash register and all of that. There was no scanning. You didn't scan. There were no barcodes. I know some of you that are younger can't imagine a world like that. But there were no barcodes. There was no scanning, no anything. And when all of that technology was just proposed, it happened in the mid-70s when people began to say, within 10 years, technology is going to be here. It scared premillennialists to death. And you know why? Because if you could scan, and if you notice, had to scan, what would it be? Mark of the beast. Notice as it describes it here with the mark of the beast. The Bible says here of the beast, he causes all, verse 16 if you read it, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. It was the time when it was just beginning to be. I remember we'd go to an amusement park or whatever and you got stamped. You still do today, but that was the first time you got stamped with something that was scanned. And it was in your hand. And it could be on your head. And here was the idea. Here it is. Mark of the beast. And that's just one step away from somebody with enough power, mind you, to say, if you don't wear a mark on your hand, and you don't wear a mark on your head, you can't buy food. You can't eat. And as this pamphlet went on to describe, hunger is a great motivation. If you want to force all the people of the world who have not yet submitted to submit, you make them receive a mark that says they belong to you forever for the rest of their life, or they can't buy and sell, do business, etc. They can't live. And it would send Christians scurrying into the caves like had not been since the days of the catacombs, etc., etc. It scared me. I remember that thing being passed out, that guy talking about that. I remember looks coming over my grandmother and other adults. I looked at them. I couldn't believe the looks they had on their face. They were scared to death. But you realize the power, fascination people have with that whole idea. Because you see, they were all sitting there saying, yeah, that could happen. I could see that happening. The mark of the beast. The Antichrist. You realize then that Revelation 13 becomes the passage. And the mark of the beast becomes the thing. And you realize that this doctrine then grabs the attention of people. I've known people at seminary, for example, who would literally start, we talked in the business meeting about, you know, things we can do to attract people to a website, to promote this whole spiritual life. We're trying to, you know, reach out to people. I knew people in seminary that used the whole idea of just what I talked about to scare people on the street into listening to this whole doctrine. Because it was something that people could see. They could believe it. You know, what would happen if you got to a point where you were, it was demanded of you. Somebody had enough power to demand that you enlist, you worship Him, you say He is God, whatever in the world it is, or you can't buy food. Have you thought about that, they would say. Do you know the Bible teaches that that's going to happen? And people would get scared. Not everybody, of course, but enough to listen. It's a powerfully attracting doctrine. Now, of course, there's an answer to it. And I've already said it, and we can look at it, and we can look at Revelation 1, and I would say this to people. I say, man, you know, you're out here saying this kind of thing to people. What about Revelation 1 that tells you Revelation 13 is about John's day, not our day? What about that? Well, just ignore that. I mean, shortly is a relative term, isn't it? You know, close at hand, near at hand. What is that? A year? 2 years? 1,000 years? 2,000 years? Relatively speaking, it is near, etc. And that's how it was explained away. But this was the chapter. So the Antichrist. Finally, in Revelation 16, and for that matter, turn over to Revelation 19. And this is seen as the most diabolical part of it. I've mentioned all around it, but let's say it directly. You look in Revelation 19 as Jesus is ultimately, and we'll come back to this passage. We'll talk about Armageddon and the end of it all and all of that. But when Jesus is finally victorious, you'll notice in verse 19, the enemies of Jesus are destroyed. I saw the beast, the kings of the earth and the armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse, that's Jesus, and against his army. And the beast was taken with him, notice, the false prophet. This beast in Revelation 13, who is the emperor, I'm convinced, begins to be described. Revelation 16 really portrays it, and again here in chapter 19 you can see it. But he's described as being the great false prophet, the one who preaches a new world religion. And if you study this doctrine, you'll see a lot of discussion about the new world religion. What happens is, just to put it very brief, this leader begins in a nation, maybe the United States. He grows in power. He eventually rules or influences the rule, but for all practical purposes, rules over the whole earth. And when he gets to that point, he begins to demand a restored Judaism-type religion that we'll touch on briefly at the end of the sermon. But he demands that people worship according to that new religion. And it begins to evolve. And as it evolves, basically it evolves to the point that it's less and less Judaism and less certainly worship of God and more worship of Him. So he becomes a false prophet, that is a false, if you will, Messiah or Antichrist. And so when he's destroyed, you see that he's destroyed as the false prophet. But you'll notice what it says about him. The beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that worked miracles before it, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. They were, of course, cast into the lake of fire. The Antichrist. Now, obviously, if you do a careful exegesis of these passages, you realize what they're talking about. The question is, does the Bible ever talk about an Antichrist? Does it ever use the term, or where did it come from? It's obviously not in 2 Thessalonians 2 or Revelation 13, so where did it come from? Well, it is a biblical term. If you go to the book of 1 John, you'll see it used in chapter 2, verses 18 and 22, and again in chapter 4 and verse 3, and again in 2 John 7. It's used both singularly, the Antichrist, that is the one that does this, that denies Jesus has come in the flesh, is an Antichrist. And it's used in the plural. There are, John says, if you're looking at 1 John 2, many antichrists. Because all the word means is anybody who is against Christ. I mean, Jesus really used the term, even though it's never translated like that. But he that is not with me is against me. He's anti-me. And that's all it really means. So yes, there were many antichrists in the first century. There are many, many antichrists today. And as long as time goes on, there will be many people against Jesus Christ. But obviously, these people are not using the term that way. Now, briefly, just for a couple of minutes, and I'll close. Let me mention this whole idea of the restored Judaism I talked about. In order for this whole thing to work, let's say that a guy, and generally this is the way it's portrayed, at least this is the way I've been taught, a guy is elected as president in the United States. Most popular one we've ever had. Something special about him, etc. He's overwhelmingly elected and loved. Popularity, you know, polls are off the scale. You see where I'm going with all that. It gets to the end of his two terms. Nobody wants him to leave office. They do away with the amendment that limits him to two terms. He stays in. His power grows. The love for him grows. He secures the nations of the world. He allies himself with the loved nations of the world. He's in close coalition with Israel. He's in close coalition with the European nations, all those that we would consider favorable, and that's where it starts. He's against the mean people of the world. And he's going to eliminate all of that, all the division, all the heartache, all the problems. It's a great, you know, presumptuous idea, but he starts accomplishing it. He's going to eliminate things like global warming and sickness and epidemics and hunger and all of that. And with the help of all these nations that get on board, he accomplishes it one by one. And his power and the love for him grows. And then he begins a transition toward a religious figure. He has revelations from God, he says, divine authority to do these things, such as institute a new world religion. All the denominational divisions and all the divisions of faith in the world, God says, are to be eliminated. And we're all to be one, just as Jesus wanted. And that one is going to be what the Bible talks about the most. And if you go to all these Old Testament passages, you see all these prophecies talking about a restoration of Israel, a reformation of Israel. Peter spoke of the times of refreshing for Israel. And so it moves to the point where now Israel is elevated and the temple is rebuilt, and all of these things are pointing toward the whole world uniting in the one great faith, not of Christianity, but of a restored Judaism. But who's the central figure of worship? Is it Allah? Is it Jesus? Is it this one? No. It's the Antichrist. And he elevates himself and he begins to be worshipped. And because he does that, people begin to rebel. And now I'm getting ahead of the story. Where does all that come from? Well, it comes from passages like, turn to Ezekiel very quickly. Those of you in the Wednesday night class, this is what we're going to study Wednesday night. But in Ezekiel 27 and 28, I'm in last week's Ezekiel class. But if you look in the book of Ezekiel, let me look at my notes here. Somewhere. 37. Okay, yeah. I knew 27 didn't sound right. All right, 37, yes. Ezekiel 37, 38. This is where Ezekiel speaks of the valley of the dry bones. And if you look at this passage, drop down to, what is it, verse 10 here. And you notice how the prophecy comes to Ezekiel to go into this valley of the dry bones. And God begins to speak to build it back up. Put flesh and sinew and all of this on these bones. And he builds it back. This is seen as the restoration of Israel. And if you continue to look at this prophecy, you'll notice down in verse 16. And this becomes a great prophecy to these people in this belief. Saw a man take a stick and write on it for Judah, and take another stick and write on it for Israel, or for Ephraim, or for Joseph. They're all synonymous terms in the prophets. And notice how, verse 17, he joins them together. This is where all the Jews are finally and ultimately joined together again. And they're all, notice how they would be attracted. They all come home to Israel. Why? because the Temple Mount is secured. I mean, that's the ongoing thing in Israel. Has been for how long now? Taking that temple back, that Temple Mount back. Well, it's taken back. And the temple's rebuilt and rededicated. And these Jews amassed Israel. And that becomes the core of the new religion. And people convert to it and the religion grows. It all comes from prophecies like this. There's a complete ignoring, as we've talked about so many times in here, a complete ignoring of the fact that these prophecies point to what happens in the New Testament. Sure, it was a burning question on the mind of the Jews. Acts chapter 1, verse 16. Will you again at this time restore Israel? It was a burning question, but Jesus answered it. Jesus had said, for example, in Matthew 21, the kingdom was going to be taken from the Jews, not given back to them, but taken from them and given to another nation. And that nation was going, just as all these prophets, and I encourage you to go home and read them, from Isaiah to Malachi, as all these prophets indicate, a reunification, yes, of Israel and Judah, but together with Gentiles into one great nation. And that great nation, we see it beginning in Acts chapter 2. All these Jews from all these different places gather back at Jerusalem. And they hear the message that unites them because they're willing to call upon the name of the Lord. And together with all those from afar off, Gentiles who will call upon the name of the Lord, they become the one nation of God, the Israel of God, consistently spoken of throughout the New Testament. The writers say, you are the Israel of God. You, the church, is God's Israel. If you look back, and I'll say this in close, if you look back at these prophecies, whether it's Ezekiel or Isaiah or Daniel, and I encourage you to do this, watch for three things. And I hope, like Rick Perry, I don't forget what they are, but watch for these three things. Watch, first of all, for the fact that it speaks of a reunification of Israel and Judah, a restoration. Watch, secondly, for the fact that it always speaks of Gentiles being added to that, such as the New Testament does. Watch thirdly for the indication in every single passage that it is going to happen in the last days, pointing you directly to Acts chapter 2. And when Peter stands up and addresses that united mass of Jews, what is the first thing he says? This is that spoken by the prophet Joel in the last days, such and such. Every single passage. You can go home and check me on that. Now we'll come back and we'll talk about the rapture and we'll talk about Armageddon and all of that kind of thing. And I know several of you had a number of questions about it, and I hope I answer them in these lessons. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, be a Christian. The great religion of the world, the greatest that the world has ever seen or ever will see, is the worship of Jesus, the only one who deserves our worship. Confess your belief in Him, your willingness to obey Him. Repent, be baptized for forgiveness of your sins. If you've done that and you need to confess something or put something behind you or begin again, He's not a deceptive leader. He's a great, merciful God. Believe in Him and give your devotion to Him. Won't you please come? I'll be standing soon.